Welcome to the Jackie Always Unplugged podcast, where we're having off-the-record conversations. I'm Reverend Dr. Jackie Reese, founder and president of the Marcello Project. As a pastor, preacher, and thought leader, I've walked with women of faith for decades and had thousands of conversations about what women encounter solely because they are women. At work, family, their faith, with relationships, sex, the church, their bodies, and Jesus. On this podcast, we're going to be asking hard questions, dealing with real issues, and revisiting scripture with a new lens. These conversations are going to put words to your female experience. They're going to ennoble you as Jesus intended and encourage you to bring your full self to the table. It's here we're going to reshape our view.
For decades, Jackie and I have been reading books and articles explaining the departure of men's engagement in the church. Books like Why Men Hate Going to Church, and we've heard preachers share false statistics like, if you get the father or the husband, then you'll get the whole family. So it may surprise some of our listeners to hear a recent New York Times article where it was stated that Gen Z females are leaving the church at a higher rate than men. In the article, Ruth Graham interviewed young men who are a part of Grace Church in Waco as they are attracting many young men in their congregation, but curiously, women are lacking. She also interviewed in the article two young women who have been struggling with the church and/or left the church. As she says, quote, young women, it seems, are moving past the debates and out the church doors. About two-thirds of women ages 18 to 29 say that most churches and religious congregations do not treat men and women equally, the Survey Center on American Life found. Now, I have mentored dozens of young millennials and Gen Z women who have faithfully served the church or in their parachurch organizations, and I have recently watched many of them walk away from it all. But I gotta say, I feel a lot of the same things that they are feeling, the same frustrations with the church, and I see the same discrepancies with the way that churches behave and the kingdom that I see Jesus bringing in the New Testament. So today, we're going to talk about why Gen Z women are leaving, and if you're one of them or have a kid that is, we want you to know that there are women out there like Beth Allison Barr and organizations like the Marcello Project that can help you on your faith journey.
Well, welcome back. You just heard from my colleague, Karen Smith, who sent me this New York Times article and said, can we talk about this? And I was like, oh, let's talk about it. And let's get Beth Allison Barr on the line and see what she has to say. So Karen, tell us a little bit about who Beth is for those who don't know, which, hey, if you haven't, time to learn about Beth.
Beth, we are excited you're here. Beth Allison Barr has a PhD from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and she is the James Vardaman Endowed Chair of History at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, where she specializes in medieval history, women's history, and church history. She is the author of USA Today bestseller, The Making of Biblical Womanhood, How the Subjugation of Women Became Gospel Truth, and her work has been featured by NPR and The New Yorker, and she has written for Christianity Today, The Washington Post, and The Dallas Morning News, Sojourners, and Baptist News Global. Barr lives in Texas with her husband and Baptist pastor and their two children. Welcome, Beth.
Thank you for having me.
We're so glad you're here. So, Beth, you were recently quoted in this New York Times article, and one of the quotes was, the complementarian turn has really reduced the visibility of women in the church. And so today we're talking about this article and why Gen Z women are leaving the church. But first, can you explain to our listeners what you mean by the complementarian turn, and what do you mean by the reduced visibility of women in the church?
I would love to talk about both those things. I think it's really important that people understand that the teaching that is so prevalent in many conservative evangelical churches, that complementarianism, which is the theology that teaches that men are to be the leaders and women are to follow. In fact, as one pastor's wife book that I recently read put it, it is a followship role for women, which I found very interesting, that this teaching is not something that has been a continuous part of church history. And in fact, it is not really until the 1980s that we see a hardening of ideas about women in the church, and we see the growth of what becomes complementarian theology, which is created in 1986, 1987, and then made known to the whole evangelical world when it was published in Christianity Today in the Danvers Statement in 1989. And this is where we begin to see a hard push for this theology that argues that women cannot be in leadership over men in churches. In the beginning, the argument is that women can still do almost anything in the church as long as they aren't the primary ones involved. But since the introduction of this hard turn of complementarianism in the late 1980s, what we have seen is evangelical churches make it more and more difficult for women to be in any sort of leadership roles, including doing things like putting rules saying that women cannot teach men over the age of 12, which is a really bizarre sort of point that they add into it. We also have recently seen the Southern Baptist Convention argue that women cannot hold any type of pastoral leadership within the church. And if they do have the title of pastor within what they do at this church, then it'll make their church possible for being disfellowshipped, no longer seen as in fellowship with the Southern Baptist Convention. So those are, I think, for women to do ministry in the church is becoming increasingly difficult. And this is also accompanied by the fact that, you know, a couple of years ago, I think in 2023, Jen Wilkin published that really fantastic article in Christianity Today, where she talking about research also coming out of the Southern Baptist world, out of Lifeway, found that 83% of female ministry leaders in churches were either volunteers or part-time or not paid at all. I mean, this is absolutely significant. So that's one of the things I mean about being less visible. And then also just go to churches' websites. Seriously, this is something Kate Bowler did in her book For the Preacher's Wife, and trying to figure out what women's titles were in churches. And it is a all-male ballgame on many of these pages, unless you are an administrative assistant. And then you might get your face. So all of those things contribute to the lack of visibility for women.
Okay, I've got to ask a couple questions. First, let me say, I love, go look at the websites. I live in an apartment complex, and I was with a man who, I was talking to a man, and he was telling me he comes from a very egalitarian, he didn't use those terms, but world, where his mom was always in leadership, et cetera, et cetera. Well, in Austin, he's now attending this church. I won't give the name. But I know it's a high complementarian church. And I said to him, oh, well, that's interesting because you go to blank, blank, blank. And he goes, yeah. And he goes, and I said, but you understand they're not egalitarian. He goes, well, what do you mean? And I go, well, how many women have you seen preach from the pulpit? How many women have the title pastor? And it like, he went like, oh, like he, it didn't even occur to him to look. Just turn, look around, right? So he thinks he's in this great church that promotes women. And meanwhile, he hadn't even taken note, which I then said, well, you have the privilege not to notice because you're a white male. And so therefore, but I want to ask this question,
absolutely,
right? He didn't have to look because he wasn't the odd person in the room. But you make the statement, there's a hard complementarian turn in the 80s. This was not something I had intended to ask. Sorry, Karen, but what provoked that turn?
Oh gosh. Let me give you the short answer of what provoked this turn. Really, the short answer is that in the 60s and the 70s, we see some significant gains for women in the U.S. This is the time when you think about legally, women, suddenly it is illegal to harass women in the workplace. It is illegal to fire women for being pregnant or getting married, which was common practice. It is illegal to not allow women to take out loans in their own name without getting male cosigners, so women can buy cars and buy houses without having to have male cosigners. And, you know, it always shocks my students how recent this is. I mean, this is really, right. This is really between like 1967 and the late 70s is when we see all of these gains. And mostly they are through the Supreme Court, which is because in the U.S., the Equal Rights Amendment, which is also something that comes up in the 70s, actually failed in the 70s. Yeah. It passed at the Senate and the House, but then it was not ratified by the states. And the Equal Rights Amendment is something that women in the U.S. had been trying to get passed since the suffrage bill. And it would declare that women, like men, are fully equal under the law. Which is not in the Constitution of the U.S. And in the 70s, as women start making all of these gains within the law courts, there starts to be a conservative push within Christian spaces. It was a coalition between conservative Catholicism and conservative evangelicals. Part of it is rooted in the issue of abortion. You can think about Roe v. Wade as passed in the early 70s too. You know, and we often think about abortion with this, but, you know, I remember stories like my hairdresser used to tell me about she couldn't get birth control without getting her husband's permission from her doctor. And so, I mean, it's all of these types of things that are opening up for women in the 70s. And we see the churches begin to push back through this conservative movement to fight against the ERA. I mean, this is one of the most fantastic moments. I mean, it's for as a historian, it is fascinating to me as much as it is horrifying, the success of the fight against the ERA. This also is going on at the same time that because of all of these educational barriers that have come down and these workplace barriers that have come down, we see women moving into seminaries, especially into pastoral tracts in unprecedented numbers. And we begin to see an uptick. Now, it's still small because women getting to be pastors has been very challenging in the 20th century U.S. But we see more women moving into ordained roles and moving into seminaries, not in the religious education degree, but in the Master of Divinity degree because they want to become pastors. And so it is absolutely no surprise that we see sort of some of these members in churches that grew out of the anti-ERA movement, but also with white men who are concerned about the pulpit joined together. And we see the formation of the Council for Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. We see the Southern Baptist Convention in 1984 make a bizarre resolution. I mean, that really is, I just watched the 1984. You can actually see it online, and I just watched the whole thing. And in 1984, they declared that women cannot be pastors because of the sin of Eve. Which is a really unprecedented statement coming from them. And so all of this is happening in the 80s as a direct response to the social, economic, cultural gains that women have made in the U.S. So complementarianism is actually a social, cultural movement. It is not rooted in the Bible. It is rooted in this social, cultural moment.
Hear that, people. Hear that statement right there. Because I think we've been trained to think it's been around forever. This has been the way it's always been done. One of the things, and then we're going to move on, but one of the things that has been discouraging to me, and even a bit surprising, is that women don't seem to understand the rights in which we have recently gained. Yes. The younger generation just takes for granted that they can go get on the birth control, whether they're married or not, right? Like, they take for granted that they even exist and that they can plan their own families and buy a car and go to college and, you know, own their own house. I mean, these are not be beaten by their husband legally. You know, these are new things. And I don't think the younger generation actually knows that they didn't have those rights not that long ago. Not that long ago.
I think one of the most important classes I teach right now is my Votes for Women class, which is mostly to freshmen at Baylor, because it is so eye-opening to them. And one of the exercises I have them do is they go interview a woman in their family or somebody close to their family who lived through some of these changes, who tells them. And so, I mean, it's always, they come back to me and they're like, my grandma couldn't write, you know, she couldn't write checks without my granddad's name on them. And I'm like, yeah, where do you think that came from? And so, I mean, it's just astonishing to them that how right. that it's within people who are still alive today who did not have some of these freedoms.
I think it's interesting to me. I would categorize myself in that younger audience in that this was all very new to me. I need to come take your class, Beth. But it's really fascinating to me to learn about the history and to see my own life in terms of where I was born into the system of believing that this is how it always was in church and the culture that I've been around and thinking this is any feminist pushing in theology is new and therefore wrong. Mm-hmm. And realizing through work like yours, Beth, that has showed me that that is not the case. There are women in the early church that were moving and doing things and preaching. And that's been really eye-opening to me and just the history, like you said, of family and realizing, wow, my own mom couldn't do these things that I do take for granted.
Right.
So the article is going back to it. It's talking about Gen Z women, and it says 61% of Gen Z women identify now as feminist, far greater than women from previous generations. It says younger women are more concerned about the unequal treatment of women in American society and are more suspicious of institutions that uphold traditional social arrangements. It goes on to talk about a poll that they conducted and where nearly two-thirds of young women say they don't believe that churches treat men and women equally. So, Beth, do you agree with that this is one of the reasons women are leaving the church? And if so, what do you think these women are experiencing and noticing?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was interesting. I'm going to write a Substack on this, but after that New York Times article came out, and you can imagine it kind of caused a little bit of a firestorm in Waco. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I'll say this, before Ruth Graham reached out to me, I was not aware of this church. I have now since learned of a lot of people who go to it, who I've come, but I was not actually aware of it. So she came to me with sort of like, hey, I've seen this. This is the research. Does this surprise you? And I was like, no, this doesn't surprise me at all, because this is a trend that has been growing. And, I think I think the church, the conservative evangelical church, has been somewhat sheltered from this for a while because we know that most church growth actually does not come from new Christians. It actually mm-hmm. comes from people from other churches going to a church. Mm-hmm. So for example, after this article came out, my hometown interviewed a pastor in town who I like him. I've known him. My husband knows him and has worked with him a lot, but he's at a very large church in Waco. And he was like, this isn't happening in our church. We have, I'll look at this. We have 1,000 college kids who are coming. And, and both my husband and I just kind of shook our heads and we were like, just wait. Wait. You are experiencing the kids who are coming to your church are the kids who have grown up in church and are just going this way. And what we are seeing, where we are seeing this hit first are with people who are not as familiar with the church, who have been less involved in the church or a little bit on the outskirts of it. And they're walking into these places and they're like, I don't see anyone who looks like me preaching or teaching. When I feel gifted to do these things, I'm told I cannot do these things. Then I find out people aren't getting paid for these things. And I find out it's really hard for me to go to seminary to do these things. And then I find out at a commencement speech after I've spent 4 years working on a degree that somebody stands up and says, your best calling is to be a wife and a mom instead of using your degree. This is the message these women are hearing. And mm-hmm. I teach these women. They are in my classes. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, they are tired of it. They are absolutely tired of it. And I see this as something that's going to start snowballing. And if history tells us anything, it's that the church cannot work without women at the background, at the, you know, supporting it. And so I'm really wondering what's going to happen.
Yeah, I have seen the same in mentoring young women in our town, and this growing, increasing frustration in many of their lives when they sort of wake up and are like, wait a minute, what can women do here? And why don't I ever see a woman on stage praying, or, you know, whatever it is? And so when this article came out, I went to lunch with one of these millennial friends pretty recently. We were talking about the article, and I know that she's been struggling and has recently left church. And so I was asking her just about that, like, tell me more, help me, you know what are your reasons for not going to church anymore? And so these were some of the things that she shared. She said, being told that we cannot trust our bodies or our intuitions.
Yeah.
Being told that your life is a waste or selfish if you don't get married or choose to have children. That my friends that are gay and watching the church be homophobic towards them. She noted the church feels behind in mental health practices, and that women feel more likely to go to therapy.
Yeah.
She said our emotions are bad, which makes this whole thing full circle. And then she also noted just the burnout. She's a young married, a burnout of having to do the mental load of running a house and then provided free labor at church, which is so often childcare, and watching that her husband doesn't have that same pressure to serve at church. And so as I was talking with her, I thought, man, this is something that I myself have wrestled with the last couple of years, specifically in terms of church, feeling like they want my body, but not my heart or my giftings. Mm-hmm. And the church I was at wanted me, I felt like, in order to count the numbers or to serve in childcare or to serve as a greeter, but they weren't interested specifically in discipling me and the gifts that made me unique. And so, and yet, all of my life, I can think back even to when I was a child, looking at like youth-led services that were young men and them being mentored, guys in seminary being shoulder-tapped and mentored by other men, and they're discipled and their gifts are called out and used. So what do you think, Beth, why do churches seem to disciple men and encourage them, but women are simultaneously pressured to serve but aren't discipled?
Yeah, no. So honestly, I think this is part of this that's come out of this hard complementarian turn, because what we see is this idea that women are to belong underneath the leadership and the teaching and the governance of men, which means that the people who really need to be targeted, because the ones that God calls to do the work of the church, are the men. And so women are supposed to happily provide. Y'all are going to love my next book, by the way.
We can't wait.
You know, it was really eye-opening to me about how all of this worked together, including the role of the pastor's wife. But, you know, women are called to support all of this. And they're told things like, you know, your support makes all of this happen, you know, all of this happen, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, what we've seen happening in these churches is they have been focusing less and less on the women. So you think about, like, in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, there were these tremendous women's movements. And these, you think about Beth Moore Bible studies. Yeah, I've learned about one called Barbara O'Chester, who had this amazing women's ministry. I mean, it was conservative, but it was also a place that was focused on by churches. And, you know, think about Beth Moore Ministries. They were safe places for women to go, and women could be with other women, and they felt like they were being mentored, et cetera. But it's this complementarian, this hard complementarian turn begins in the 80s. What we find is churches being taught that they really need to focus on the men, and that we need to actually control these female spaces more. And this has come out even more recently. I was on a podcast with Sheila Gregor, and we were talking about that 93% myth statistic, which is completely made up.
I have heard that time and time again.
Hold on a second. Can you share that with our audience? Because they may not be aware of that. Sorry, go ahead.
One of the books that y'all said that you've talked about a lot is Why Men Hate Church. This is one of the books that contains it in it. And it is often stated in different ways, but mostly what it says, if a child goes to church first, only like, I don't know, like 3% of times will the family follow. If a woman goes to church first, only something, I don't remember what it is, it's like 16% or 17% or something times the family will follow. But if a man goes to church, then 93% of the time his family will follow. And this is a statistic. I've heard this. My husband brought it home to me from our pastor and was like, what do you think of this? It is in a Promise Keepers book. There is no study that goes along with it. I will stand here and tell you as a scholar from all of the evidence I have been looking into this, I think they made it up. Mm-hmm. I think they made it up. I don't know who made it up, but I think they made it up because there is no research behind it. And in fact, most research goes against it.
I think immediately I went to Lydia in the Bible. I'm thinking, she brought her family to faith. I mean, we have examples of women in the scripture who brought their families to faith.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, Daniel Silliman had a recent article in Christianity Today that said, if you're a Christian, thank your mom. And he based it on recent research. This is actual real recent research that shows the significant influence of mothers on the lasting faith of children. Now, I'm not trying to pit male spirituality against female spirituality. Right. I think both men and women need to be in this game together. Mm-hmm. But
agreed.
The church, with this complementarian move and this emphasis, you think about Promise Keepers, all of this emphasis, we've got to build up these men. And the focus shifts to these men. And they become the primary people that are focused on. And the trickle-down effect is this pushing out of these women's ministries or controlling them better. Mm-hmm. I've heard so many stories of women being like, you know, now our Bible studies, we have to like get the material cleared with the pastor. And in fact, the pastor is now telling us what we have to teach and that it's becoming second place to like men's ministries. If the church is going to invest in
I want to pause there and just I really want the audience to hear that because I too have encountered that anecdotally. I don't have any research, but What Beth just said is women's ministry now needs to report what they're teaching and what they're doing and get approval from the male pastor, a male pastor. Yep. And you are exactly right. In Dallas, I know for a fact, several mega churches, they really keep control of the women's ministry. If it gets too big, too... if you will, full of the spirit, like starting to like blow and make things happen, you know, like ministries start popping out of it and all, they start shrinking it because it cannot get too big. And so hear me out there in the audience, because a lot of women who attend church do not see this, but those of us who are behind the scenes, we do. And it's bizarre that a women's ministry would be run by a man.
Yes, it is.
So go ahead.
No. So, I mean, you're exactly right. The Village Church, go look at the Village Church.
Yes.
You can look at J.D. Greer in the Southern Baptist Convention. He actually started I'm about 98% positive it was Greer. Sometimes all these guys run together in my head.
Yeah, I know. I get it.
But I'm pretty positive it was Greer, as president of the Southern Baptist Convention. They actually pushed, based upon this statistic, this emphasis on men's ministry. I can also tell you that, and I said this in Sheila's podcast that I was on, that this actually happened in the church my husband got fired from very shortly before he got fired. The women's ministry group, the women's Bible studies that were actually doing extremely well got consolidated, and where everybody had to meet together and the material was provided by the pastor and you had to go in breakout groups and the leaders were appointed through the pastor, through these women. I mean, and it was, and at the time it was like, what's going on? This is like absolutely bizarre. And now it makes sense to me. I understand how it fits into this pattern.
And let me interject here. Hold on one second. Because if I don't say this, and Karen, hold. But the reason I want the audience to understand, the reason why, because they may be going, well, what's wrong with the pastor giving the material? It keeps everybody on the same page, the same.
Yes.
What does a man understand about the female experience? What does a man understand about what a woman goes through of having to make choices about babies, marriage, work and family life, her body changing through hormones? You know, no, a man does not understand a female experience fully. And we know for a fact that, because this is my research, doctoral research, is that women who study the scriptures see different things in the scriptures that men don't catch, much based on our socialization. And so we are able to speak as females in a female body with a female voice to the female experience. Yes. That is why we do not, it is one of the reasons we do not want men dictating to us what we would be teaching. What would be missing out of this is the female experience to the female experience. Along with what we're communicating to women is men are theologically scholared and able to give us our doctrine and our theology, not women. Right. Even though that's not stated, that's what's being picked up implicitly. So that's my rant because that's my area.
Karen was.
Karen, I was just going to say, I remember being part of a church where this discussion came up of the head pastor concerned, but seemingly in a good way, over what the women were teaching. But the women at that time were doing a Beth Moore Bible study, and the conclusion was that he couldn't look at it because he might learn something from Beth Moore while reading it, and therefore opted not to look at it and just trust that it was okay.
The rules are so bizarre. Trying to figure out how to navigate these rules just takes so much time and so much energy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think this piece of devaluing women's ministry within churches, making women less visible, is connected to the piece of not paying women for the work that we do.
Absolutely.
And, yes.
And this puts a qualification. This says, you know, and then we gaslight women and say, you should do this for ministry. You know, this is because this is what God has called you to do, to be the support staff. And honestly, I think the pastor's wife role was used in this way. In the evidence. Yes. And actually, I'm speaking on evidence of there. I've read 150 pastor's wife books. And so I can stand on evidence based upon this. Mm-hmm. And it is really terrifying to me how that role has been used to make women accept a lesser position that has less authority, that is not paid and is devalued in the church, and telling people that this is the only thing God has called you to do. And
right.
it is belittling to women, mm-hmm. and it is belittling to God.
And unhealthy for the church.
On God.
Yes. Unhealthy for the church. Unhealthy for the church.
Absolutely.
I think one woman said this to me, experiencing exactly all that we've been talking about. She said, I feel overused and underutilized. Mm. Overused, and my body is present. I'm serving in every area. Underutilized in the gifting, much like Karen has experienced and has voiced. Her gifting, which is preaching and pastoring, was underutilized. Never discipled, right? So back to the article, I think the thing that caught my attention, and I'll read it, is that young women are still spiritual and seeking. So we're talking about the fact that these women are leaving the church, but we want to take note they are still spiritual and seeking, according to surveys of religious life. But they came to be during the age of the Me Too movement that opened a national conversation about sexual harassment and gender-based mm-hmm. abuse, which inspired this widespread exposure of abuse in the church settings under that hashtag #ChurchToo. And then there was the overturning of Roe versus Wade in 2022 that compelled many of them to begin to pay closer attention to the reproductive rights that are on display. And then the article said young men have different concerns. They are less educated than their female peers. In major cities, including New York and Washington, they earn less. At the same time, they place a higher value on traditional family life, which would be an interesting question of why. What does it benefit them versus why women are not? childless men, young men, are likelier than childless young women to say they want to become parents someday by a margin of 12% points, according to this survey. The young men at Grace and Hope churches are, quote unquote, looking for leadership, they're looking for clarity, and they're looking for meaning, the pastor says at Hope Church. Later in the article, we hear the pastor say this, and I think this is very interesting. He says, the guys are just hungry. And the implication there, people, is women are not. Guys are just hungry. Young men are attracted to harder truths. Sometimes he wants to hear messages with a little, quote unquote, wrath of God in them. I have been studying gender issues in the church for decades. And this, to me, this statement that these pastors just made and what we're hearing is like a rinse and repeat. It feels like this is a conversation that the church has been having forever. Men just want to have, you know, the harder conversations, and they're just hungry. And you know, we saw this in the 1950s. We saw this in the 1920s. Here we are again. Is this just another expression of the battle over gender roles, or is this something new that we're observing here?
So yes and no. That's a phrase my students are so tired of.
As any theologian would say.
All the time. Yeah, it's yes and no. There is continuity, especially in the U.S. experience, because throughout the 20th century, you mentioned the 20s, the 50s, and now all of those moments, those time periods when you mentioned, are times of great social upheaval and change.
Yes.
And thinking about, you know, you think in the post-World War I era, you think about the post-World War II era, and now you think about the modern era today, which is post a whole lot of stuff that has changed our entire civilization. And so a lot of it is this yearning to go back to this imagined golden age, which, you know, and I think part of this is the way our theology has taught this. And you can also think, I've become more and more convinced that the Bill Gothard teachings about the umbrella covering the family, and if you let the man cover the family, then you're going to be okay. And everything's going to be okay. And there's a lot of yearning for that, because there's a lot of things that are not okay in this world. And it's a hard place. And so I think there's this yearning for this. I also think that sometimes what pastors are saying is not always what women in their church spaces are hearing. So for some extent, like this pastor may be saying this about what young men are wanting. I now know there's a lot of women in his church who are actually graduate students at Baylor, et cetera, who are in their own community groups and are working with each other. And, you know, their experience is different than what they heard in that article. And so I think there still is enough of a separation of the sexes. You know, I think part of this is that male pastors are unaware and unconnected to what a lot of women are doing. And I think this is what we have done to them. You know, all of these Billy Graham rules, all of this, we have disconnected them. And so maybe what male pastors are doing and are trying to do and focusing on, is it takes a while for that harm to reach down to all the women within their congregation. Because women, you know, it's always amazing to me, another continuity in history is that women keep doing the work that they can do in the spaces that they are allotted for as long as they are able to do it.
That's right. So
sometimes it takes a long time for churches to feel the impact of women getting tired and walking away, because women persist until we just can't any longer. And
That's interesting, because so a lot of this article is talking about Gen Z women leaving, but I also see around me, even women our age. And I think naturally there is this, like, when you turn 40, you kind of wake up to some things and come out of what I call crazy baby land. And like your head's coming up from water, but you're suddenly taking note of, like, wait a minute, why is this happening? Or why am I being treated this way? And so Jackie and I have both seen some rumblings in women in their 40s and over who are also leaving the church in large numbers, unlike before. And so just the other day, I was talking to a woman, a good friend, and she's in her 50s, but she was talking about this disconnect that she sees between the workplace and church. This particular woman has held really high positions in the workforce and positions of of authority, and now she's in her 50s, in some ways waking up to this realization of, when I walk in those church doors, all that's expected of me is a casserole.
Yes.
And she's frustrated with that.
Yeah. So, no, I think, go on, Jackie.
Well, no, go ahead, address that.
I was just thinking, you know, we think about women in their late 20s and 30s in the church, and often it is crazy baby land, and it is other women who are supporting those women and helping those women, and it creates this very strong community where you're kind of all in the same place. These are your friends. These are the things that you're focused on. You're not trying to do, you know, sometimes, and women who are working in these situations, they're just trying to keep things together, you know, while they're doing this, and they're not, and they have their community within those spaces, and then their kids start getting older, and they're not as, and they're like, hey, I can do more now. And then they look around in their churches and they realize they can't do more. That, you know, like for me, I know I've been accused of supporting child abandonment, et cetera. So I kind of hesitate of saying this. if you remember that, it's a whole thing.
I do remember that.
One of the funniest things ever. But I love my children, and I loved when they were babies, and I loved when they were toddlers. But I don't really have a desire to return to that stage. I really love, I love holding people's babies and handing them back. You know, it's, that's perfectly fine with me.
Agree.
Because, you know, I can teach, but, and so there, and there's a lot of women who are like that. And so if I walked into a church and somebody said, you need to do the nursery, I'm like, no. You know, I help in children in our church because our church is so tiny and we have so few helpers. And I'm like, I can sit and help things. Just don't ever ask me to teach small kids, because that is not my gifting. That is, one of the most terrifying things to me ever was when I had to run games for my preschooler's Christmas party. That was one of the most terrifying things ever, because I was like, I don't know how to do this at all. And so women, like, there's more and more women who are really like that. And you walk into a church and the only thing people give you to do is childcare and cooking. And you're like, neither of those things are my gifting. But there's no other
I in my life, never considered teaching, never thought I would like it, never thought I would enjoy it, because all I was exposed to was teaching young children, until I started teaching college girls Bible study. And then I was like, I love this. But there's a big difference between teaching adults and teaching young children in church.
Yeah, absolutely. I was a brand new Christian when I started going to church in Dallas. So got saved, moved to Dallas, and went to Dallas Theological Seminary. Bam, right? Which, by the way, is one of the seminaries that did not let women in until the 70s. And even then, very limited and what they could enroll in, et cetera, et cetera. When I was at DTS, and by the way, I'm a preacher and I'm a damn good one, but I was not allowed to take any preaching classes during that time. Because when, so all that to say, I go to church. It's my first experience in church. And I have toddlers. I have three children, 3.5 and under, in which I never wanted to be a mother, but I ended up pregnant unexpectedly, and bam, now I got kid after kid after kid. I go in and they want me to work in the nursery. And I'm like, I'm not even sure I wanted my children. I definitely don't want to work with your children. And I said to Steve, because this is my first experience with Christianity, and I turned to my husband and I said, "Is why would people choose to do this on their Sunday?" And then I realized, just like you, Karen, I have the gift of teaching, but my people group were not toddlers. My people group were adult women.
And this is exactly, and people are going to listen to us talking about this. And I can just see it, you know, is talking about these unwomanly women who's, and it's just crazy to me, because, you know, God gifted all of us in very
particular way than those giftings are broad and wide. And there's a lot of men. Like, I remember when my son was in pre-K, there was this lovely man. He was an ex-police officer. You would have never known it. And he dedicated his retirement to working with preschoolers because he loved them. I mean, this guy loved them, and he loved doing that work. And I was always like, I'm so thankful to you, Mr. Sanders, because this is not work I care about. But yet, it would have been gendered that that wasn't something he was supposed to do.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
And so, I mean, it's like, why are we creating spaces where we discriminate against how God has gifted people?
Right. And I want to say some women are gifted to mother. And I've had them come to me over the past 30 years and say, you know, I feel called to mother. And I'm like, for crying out loud, have as many babies as you can. And then after you're done having your babies, you mother every other person in your neighborhood and beyond. Mother, we need you to mother. So this isn't anti-mothering. No. And I, you know, and I want to say to those of you who are listening that will probably want to say, oh my God, she didn't want to be a mother. I remember when Steve and I met with I didn't grow up in the Christian world, so I didn't have all of these frameworks, but I was sitting with a group of our friends, all, you know, married couples in church together, that same phase where we all had kids. And the question came up, if you had to do one thing over again, what would you do differently? And my husband and I had never said this to each other, but both of us at the same time said, we might not have children. And if you could have seen the room, like, ooh, you know, and I was like, well, I'm not going to kill my kids, you know, and I want to say this. I just turned 59 this week, and my three children, who are 34, 33, and 31, showed up at my house to spend the whole weekend with me, by the way. Whatever you want to do, Mom. And I'm like, well, you guys got a lot of things going on. No. And all of their partners showed up. They cooked, they cleaned, they took care of me. My husband asked, if Mom was gone, what would you miss most? And my kids said the most beautiful things about how I mothered them. Mm. So my point being is, you can be a working mother. You can be a mother who teaches these people or that. There are all different kinds of ways of doing it. The proof of the pudding that we don't hate our children is my 30-year-old children choose to be with me.
I think what we've done to mothering, and this is completely off topic, is we have made it very narrow. We have said, this is how you mother, and this is a very particular type of mother. And that's never been historically true. You know, the amount of time and attention that we are required to focus solely on our kids is only something available in wealthy families in this very modern technology, you know, friendly era that allows parents to be able to focus that much attention on kids. You just weren't able to do it.
No, that's right.
And most places in the world, you're not. And so what we have done is we have turned mothering into something that it has never been. We've turned it into a full-time exclusive job. And said, if you don't do it this way, then you're not a true mother. And I'm just like, you know, I just want you to tell that to all of these women who for years and years and years and centuries were mothering and raising these kids in a way that
women all over the globe are mothering differently. Think broadly.
I think that's what we've done is that we have warped even the concept of mothering.
I'll call a podcast on this, I think. So maybe we need to redo. Let's move forward on the article. But I really do want to consider doing a thing on mothering because I've never talked about mothering in the 30 years. I've just started my 30 years of ministry. And partly because I thought the church, when I came into the church, they over-talked about mothering. Yeah. And I wanted to communicate women are more than mothering. You know, we mother, but we are other things also. And so I kind of ignored the topic for a very long time.
I'd love to talk about, you know, I have to say my kids are, I almost lost my son a couple of years ago. He had an undiagnosed medical condition that caused him to have a wreck. And, you know, it still haunts me. I'm just like, what a gift my children are. I love them so, so much. But at the same point in time, I also can see how much we have warped this concept of mothering and used it as a weapon to keep women from using their gifts within the church.
Yep. And even women facing each other. Go ahead, Karen.
Yes.
the mothering, I'm thinking of a lot of these young women that I'm meant to have mentored that are leaving church, but with the mothering piece of, for some of them, I'm thinking about like the holidays coming and this awkward conversation with parents who are still in church, don't understand why their daughters are leaving the church, don't see it. But to some degree, mothers who perpetuate the system and are just like, you know, fall in line. That's what I did. You need to also, some of them that I know, their parents are in church leadership, which kind of tightens that dynamic down of the expectations on this daughter and how she will behave even as a young woman in her 20s. And so what, as we think through that with mothering and maybe young women who have left this church tradition and left a community in that, what advice would you give a young woman in that situation, maybe to find community or and or how to handle Thanksgiving?
Just a minor question.
Right? You know, I mean, it's heartbreaking for so many, the pressures that we put on young women. You know, I think about young men who often, you know, through their 20s are able to go home to family things and nobody's like, when are you going to get married? And yes, women, it like starts happening like really, really
when
quickly.
When are you having kids?
When are you having kids? When are you getting married, et cetera? And I mean, and the other whole piece to this too is that childbirth is difficult and fertility is difficult. And there's so many women who desire children and can't have them, this infertility piece as well. And just that pressure that is put upon them. And so, I mean, I would tell those kids, have a frank conversation with your parents. Say, this puts pressure on me in a way that, you know, I think some might make them not want to do it at all because of the pressure that's put upon them. But also the type of life. I mean, we know that marrying somebody who is not supportive of you, who does not treat women well, et cetera, can be a life-changing event in a very negative way. Yeah. And so if you get married, you want to make sure you marry somebody who is going to support you and that you really can work together as a team. And so this is not something that parents want their kids to be making lightly. And so I would just encourage those girls to have a frank conversation with their parents and just say, we need to talk about this. And please don't do that to me. Please just let me feel like I am loved and called, that I am loved within your house, regardless of where God is going to call me. And I sometimes just saying that out loud to parents and family members can make a huge difference. You know, some parents sometimes just don't. We do what our parents did, and pressure is put on women because that pressure was put on us. Yep. So break the cycle. Tell them to stop it. And, you know, I'm always grateful for my mother-in-law, who you would think would have been so traditional in this area. But she, fertility was a problem for her. And she prayed for all three of her kids. In fact, my husband was a Clomid baby, and it was her third try. It was the last time they were going to give her Clomid. And she, I mean, she tells the story. And so she never asked me when I was going to have kids. Never.
Beautiful.
And it was a freeing thing.
Yeah. And I think as mothers, one of the things we can do is be careful to say when you get married or when you have children. Probably should never say those words, right? Because what if she doesn't find a partner to get married? What if she can't have children?
Yeah.
And Karen, I just think, you know, this idea of leaving your community, because whether it's over my family has an idea of what it looks like for me to be traditional as a mother or wife, and that's not my calling, whether it's my gifting, whether it's I can't deal with the way the church deals with homosexual, you know, theology, how they treat gay people, you know, all of those things. It's so disorienting when people leave their faith. I know, because I left my church, and I know you did, Beth, too, and I know you have too, Karen, and it's like being out in the wilderness, and it's really scary. It's really scary to say my theology, my belief system no longer aligns with the people I have belonged with because you're letting go of belonging, and belonging is scary, exactly right? Like when you, it's very scary. But I want to say to the women out there, if that's you, it feels very lonely and it feels very scary, but you are not alone. There are many of us who have taken that journey, and there are groups all over the place. And even probably within your church, there are people who feel the exact same way you feel. Find them, figure out what you believe, be okay with letting go of some things. You don't have to do it in such adversarial ways with your faith community that you've been involved with, but it may mean making you have to leave that faith community because you can no longer grow in it, you know? I want to move us to, because we need to kind of close up, but I love what Russell Moore said in the article. He said, I'm not sure what church life will look like with a decreasing presence of women. And you mentioned this, Beth. He said, pointing out that historically we have been crucial forces in missionary work and volunteering. And then he says this statement that I think is profound and perhaps a warning to the church. He said, we need both spiritual mothers and spiritual fathers.
Yep.
And that is a big fat amen.
I'm just waiting for Russell Moore to move on the women's issue. Every day I'm like, are you there yet? You know?
But you know, he's taken so much beating. He has to go slowly. I mean, this has been grief for him upon grief upon grief. We move slowly.
That is true.
I mean, Beth got there.
I think what I appreciate about him is I've been thinking about these two traits a lot theology wise. He seems humble and curious.
Yes.
And I think those two are so often required. Get stuck in our ways.
He no longer is belonging, right? He had a people group that you stay in. Like I have some friends who are in Acts 29 who have said to me, I believe as a pastor, I believe actually women are called to teach and preach. But if I take that on, I will lose my community in Acts 29. And so he will not take it on. So there's a belonging issue. Let's talk about Allison's book.
Yes.
Karen, what do you want?
So Beth, you rocked our worlds with The Making of Biblical Womanhood, and we cannot wait for your new work to come out. So what can you share with us about it?
Yeah. So Becoming the Pastor's Wife is not a sequel per se to The Making of Biblical Womanhood, but it is a more focused look at the problem or at the topic of women's ordination and how the history of women's ordination, as well as how that intersects with the rise of the pastor's wife role, and in fact, how the pastor's wife role has been used within conservative spaces to work against ordination for women and to work against in some ways, instead of women in ministry all working together because God calls us in all sorts of different ways, it has kind of pitted wives of pastors against female pastors. Which has caused, instead of us working together, has only made these rifts within the church more visible and more harmful to women. And so part of my book is hopefully reparative within this, as well as encouraging women in all of their ministry, whatever that calling may be. I think this book was, I've said The Making of Biblical Womanhood, I told people what I knew, what I'd been teaching for over a decade. Becoming the Pastor's Wife is not a story I knew before I started writing it. It's a story that I pieced together in the archives. And I found women that I had never met before that I tell some of their stories. And I also began to make even clearer links between the implications, the impact of complementarian theology for women. And my eighth chapter tells the story of a clergy sex abuse case that I did not know of before I stumbled across it in the SBC archives. I followed it all the way to Canada, and I tell the story through the eyes of a pastor's wife. And it was the hardest chapter for me to write. But I also think that it pulled the book together really well about the cost of complementarian theology for women.
Well, if it's anything like the first book.
Yes.
That's right.
Well, I'll give you a warning label. It's not quite as hopeful as that, you know, people, I'm afraid I'm going to disappoint people. It's not quite as hopeful because it's a little bit of a darker story.
Yeah, but I think that's all part of history.
Every time I see you talk about it on social media, I think about my own life in maybe instead of becoming a pastor's wife, becoming a pastor and just the roadblocks of getting there. As a young woman, I majored in biblical text in undergrad, but that was the most common comment that I got from people was, you will make a great pastor's wife. And being so conflicted of that was the culture I was in of like, thank you, but also what if I want to be the pastor?
Yeah.
What if I don't want to marry a pastor?
You know, and one of the things that I hope I capture in this story too is how much more room there was in the pastor's wife role for women to act as ministers in their own ministry until relatively recently. This is something that the pieces of this really came together for me. The pastor's wife role has changed. It has changed in a way that I don't think we recognize. And that change really began in the post-World War II era when we see a marked shift.
Well, I'm very excited to read it. I think history, whether it's dark or not, is helpful because it actually sheds light onto what is and helps us understand things, right? Mm-hmm. Like sometimes we're experiencing something and we can't put words around why or how or how do we even get here? And putting words and language to what's happened always gives us better clarity. So, Beth, I want to thank you for giving us your time. Yeah. We know how very busy you are. And Karen, I'm so glad to do this with you. And I want to encourage the women out there listening and dads out there listening who have young daughters. If there's something we've talked about today and you're, oh my gosh, that's where I'm at. I didn't even know I was experiencing this, but that's how I'm feeling. We want you to know you're not alone. You are not alone. One of the reasons we do the work we do at the Marcella Project is because we understand there's what I call women that become outliers. We're actually not becoming the outliers anymore. But when we started a long time ago, there was this small group of outliers that were becoming more than majority. You're not alone. And we're here. There are people, there are women out here who believe what you believe theologically, and we want to engage with you, whether that's through Beth. And Beth, how can they reach you or at least follow some of your work, learn from you?
Yeah, sure. So I'm mostly visible on Threads and Instagram. So I'm always Beth Allison Barr. Also, I write much more regularly now lately on my Substack, Beth Allison Barr. And so at Marginalia is what I call my Substack. And so you can find me at all of those places. And we are beginning to see marketing rev up for becoming the pastor's wife through Brazos. So you're probably going to see a lot more visibility of me coming up soon. So
do you have a release date yet?
March 18th. It's going to be a fable. You should come, Karen.
Hey, we'll be there.
I live in Austin. I can drive.
Kristen's going to join me. I think Kristen's going to come and help launch it with me.
Great.
And then I always want to say to you women out there, you know, we at the Marcella Project are here for you too. You can always reach out to us at Jackie at the Marcella Project or Karen at the Marcella Project. You can join us on Jackie Always Unplugged Facebook group. We are here for you. You do not have to do this alone. So have a great day, everybody. Thank you, Beth. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hey, if you've enjoyed this conversation, then hop on over to themarcellaproject.com and sign up for our email or check out some of our other resources. You can also find me on the Marcella Project Facebook page or on every other platform of social media as Jackie Reese, R-O-E-S-E. Have a great day.